So this is the first talk in a series of six talks, and the overall theme is the five stages of spiritual path, five stages of spiritual life. So any undertaking which involves training or learning or whatever is going to be a progressive process, yeah? So whether it's athletics or mathematics or learning a language, playing chess, whatever, learning to drive, anything you undertake which involves training and learning is a progressive process. And so with that process, first you have to learn the basics, and gradually you begin to see how everything fits together, yeah? How everything connects up. So you and by degrees you gain mastery. And then when you've really gained mastery, then you can forget everything you've learned. Yeah? And all the training just manifests as creativity, an ability to be creative. Now spiritual life is a training. And training is a metaphor that the Buddha used. The sutta that comes to mind immediately is the Badali Sutta, where he talks to Badali about the disciple being like a young horse, a foal, a colt, I think is the word used in the translation. It's like training a horse, taming it and training it. So the Buddha used this metaphor of training. So spiritual life is a graduated process, a progressive process. But the major difference when it comes to spiritual life is that we're not talking about gaining knowledge in an area of expertise. We're not concerned with mastering some particular discipline. Yeah? What we're engaged in is we're engaged in transforming the whole person, all of us, as it were, all of me, all of you, the totality of our being. Yes, and we're engaged in that. And we're engaged in that as a way of contributing to transforming the world. Yeah. So spiritual life is not an aspect of life; it's the whole of life. Yeah, it's the human response to the existential dilemma facing every human being. Yeah. So that existential dilemma is usually encapsulated in the inescapable fact of death. Yeah, so we've all got that inescapable fact in front of us, and that's our as it were existential dilemma. And that's brought out in the story of Siddhartha before he became the Buddha. The first three of the four sights that he encountered were the old person, the sick person, and the corpse. So story of Siddhartha encountering these sights as if for the first time, it's about the human dilemma, the existential dilemma that faces all human beings. It's not really that Siddhartha actually, you know, saw these things for the first time. It's more that he saw them as if for the first time. He saw the issue, as it were. He was no longer escaping from the issue, because most of us, for large periods of our life, may spend our lives escaping from those issues, in the sense of not wanting to look at them, not wanting to encounter them. So when we talk about following a spiritual path, we're talking about teachings and methods which are trying to explain to us our situation, basically. They're trying to explain our situation to us and tell us what to do about it. That's what the teachings and the methods are trying to do. And following the path, then, is about mastering the teachings and practicing the methods. But that's not the whole of it. Because mastering the teachings and practicing the methods means allowing them to transform us. It means allowing them to transform us root and branch, as it were. And that means that as we learn, as we train, we change. We become a new person. We become a different person, you could say. And as that happens, our whole perspective on what the training and the practice is about also changes. So the more we master the training and the practice, the more fresh and new and meaningful it becomes. So inevitably, when we start out on the spiritual path, we've got a particular idea about what we're trying to do, what the practices are about, and so on. But that will change as we progress, because as we progress, the practices and the training changes us, yeah? And it therefore changes how we see practice and training. Yeah? So, although Buddhism is often neatly packaged in lists, yeah, there's lists of stages of a path, it's never quite that simple. At the same time, it's not really complex. Yeah, it's just surprising. Yeah, it's just surprising. It's not necessarily complex, but it's not as simple as a list might seem to make it. So there are various formulations of the path, various ways in which the Buddhist path are talked about. We've got the threefold path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. So that's a perfectly good way of looking at the Buddhist path. Or we've got the Bodhisattva path of the six perfections, which you all remember. Generosity, ethics, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom. Or we've got the Noble Eightfold Path, which is perhaps one of the most common formulations of the path that we're all maybe familiar with. Bhante Sangharakshita translates the stages there as perfect vision, perfect emotion, perfect action, perfect speech, perfect livelihood, perfect effort, perfect mindfulness, perfect meditation. Did I miss any out? I don't think so. Speech. And then, of course, we have this one we're looking at in this series of talks, the five stages of spiritual life. So there are all these different formulations of a path, and there are more that I haven't mentioned. There are more ways that it's spoken about. And they're all very helpful in a way. In fact, it's good to have all these different ways of looking at it, and ways of talking about it, because they can throw a new light on it. Yeah. And if we were to thoroughly engage with any one of these teachings, we would find that they, in a sense, they all contain each other. Yes, they're just different formulations of the path. They're not different paths. The different formulations. So any one of these ways of looking at spiritual practice that you look at will contain the other ways of looking at it, because otherwise there wouldn't be a complete path. Yeah? And Bhante Sangharakshita has given talks and lectures and so on all of these formulations of the path and on many more. But in more recent years, he and Subhuti have been emphasizing this particular formulation of the five stages of spiritual life. That might be perhaps because this formulation brings out this graduated, progressive nature of spiritual life even more strongly than some of the other paths. And also because it's much more easily correlated with all the different practices that we do, all the different practices of meditation, ethics, spiritual friendship, retreats, and so on. All of that it fits in very well with this formulation. So this is what I'm going to be exploring over the next 12 weeks or whatever it is, this five-stage formulation of the path, yeah? Now, the main obstacle to spiritual life, you've probably all got your own sense of what that is, yeah, before I say, the main obstacle to spiritual life is an unwillingness to change, yeah, or an unwillingness to change completely. So sometimes we do want to change, but we only want to change on our own terms, yeah? We only want to change what we find uncomfortable. But sometimes it's even more important to change what we find comfortable. The main requirement, you could say, for spiritual life, it's not intellectual ability. Yeah? It's not ability as a meditator. It's not the ability to give talks. It's not about being articulate or clever or sociable. The main requirement for a successful spiritual life is this willingness to change. The willingness, and I should add, the ability to change. So change what? Change our behavior, which covers a wide gamut of things, changing our behavior from our ethical behavior to that includes our communication and so on. A willingness to change our behavior, a willingness to change our ideas, our views, our opinions, our ways of thinking, our habits, even our circumstances, our lifestyles, everything. Everything is in the melting pot. So I'm not saying that we have to change everything. We may not need to change everything, but the willingness is a key factor in making progress. This willingness to change, the willingness to transform, the willingness to open up to that possibility that everything could change. This is the other way of looking at this. This is the health warning that we need to give when people embark on a spiritual path or take up meditation. If you take up meditation, take it up seriously, take up the spiritual life, ethics, and Sangha, engage with all of that, then you can be transformed completely. Yeah. So you have to be up for that. So if we're really willing to change, then the training and the practices will work their magic. Yeah, if we're really willing to change, they'll work their magic, and the caterpillar will emerge as the butterfly. Yeah, or the acorn will become the oak tree. We will emerge from the shell of our ignorance, and do whatever happens when you emerge from the shell of your ignorance. Soar into the skies, I suppose, of wisdom and compassion. So often we are willing to change. So you might have been thinking that I'm thinking that people are not willing to change, but actually often people are willing to change. People want to change. People are willing to change often either because of suffering, which is quite common. You know, if we're suffering in one way or another, we want to change. We want to move beyond that suffering. Or for some people, maybe the lucky ones, they want to change because they're responding to the beauty and the expansiveness of the ideal of awakening. They're responding to that ideal as it's personified in the Buddha or the Bodhisattvas. And in Dharma teachers. So for all this transformation to happen, assuming we're willing to change, for all of this change, this transformation to happen, we need to pass through these stages of growth and development that are laid out in this path of five stages. These stages of integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and spontaneous compassionate activity. That's like a kind of description of the journey, as it were. And the first three of those stages, the integration, the positive emotion, and the spiritual death, they're something we do. They're like in the realm of karma, in the realm of action. The last two stages are the results of our practice. Which doesn't mean that we're not doing anything. We are doing it, but they're the results of our practice. However, how to explain this? So you could think of these five stages like five steps, stairs, as it were. So you've got integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, spontaneous compassionate activity. So that's the kind of journey, ascending journey, as it were, if you want to look at it. That's an image. And each one of those steps, you could say, has five colours. And these are the practices of integration, the practices associated with positive emotion, the practices associated with, in terms of the aspects, we talk about receptivity as well, associated with receptivity, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. So you've got two things going on at the same time. You've got a description, as it were, of states of consciousness or states of awareness that are progressing, becoming more expansive, becoming higher, whatever way you want to talk about it. And you've got a description of practices and mental states that we're trying to encourage and develop as we move along. So at each stage of higher states of consciousness, we're also practicing all of these things of integrating positive emotion, receptivity, spiritual death, and spiritual rebirth. Now, you don't need to worry about all of that. You don't need to go away and try and get an Excel spreadsheet together to try and work out what all that is. I'm going to talk about the two put together. I'm going to be talking about the stages and the practices together as I go along. So don't try and work it out in your head. It's hard enough to talk about it as well. I need a flip chart or something to draw it for you so I can explain it. Anyway, I'm going to be giving a talk on each stage. The first talk, this is the bit where, this is the advertising interlude as well. The first talk is entitled All Things Great and Small. Actually, this is the first talk, isn't it? The one I'm giving now. So the one I'm giving now did have a title. What was the title? It was From Getting Going to Letting Go. That's a good title, isn't it? Getting Going to Letting Go. I'm good at packaging. Let's hope the content is good. So the first talk on the five stages will be entitled All Things Great and Small. And that's the talk about integration. And in that talk, I'm going to talk about three kinds of integration. You want to know what they are? Come to the talk. Yeah? I'm going to talk about how we can become more integrated, and I'll tell you what I think are the key practices in relation to integration. Then in the second talk is called Choosing the Best, and that's about positive emotion. So in that talk, I'm going to talk about the basic choice we have in life. You probably know what that is already. If you don't, come to the talk and I'll tell you. I'll talk about how we can cultivate positive emotion. I'll talk about motivation, about faith, and about karma. Then in the third talk, which is on spiritual death, I've called that talk The Victorious One. So that's a strange title for that talk, but come along and I'll explain it all. I'm going to be talking about this particular metaphor of spiritual death. What that means to us, what the significance, what it signifies for us spiritually, yeah? And I'm going to talk in that talk about the two paths and their associated practices. So if you want to know what those two paths are, come along with you. And I'll tell you what I consider to be the key practices associated with spiritual death. Then the fourth talk is called A Buddha Like No Other. And in that talk, I'm going to go into the whole theme of spiritual rebirth and what that means for us. I'm going to talk about the place of imagination in spiritual life. And that talk is going to end with a little treat for you, a little surprise, special surprise, yeah, which I think you'll really like. How am I doing? Am I getting and the last talk is called Getting Out of the Way. getting out of the way. And in that talk, I'll talk about dharmic responsiveness and about spontaneous compassionate activity. And I'm going to have some more to say about faith and about karma, about a karma niyama and a dharma niyama, and about the importance of pauses and empty spaces. So that's what we're going to be doing. So now, although the path is laid out like this, in this gradual and progressive way, the reality, as we know, can be very different. Yeah, we might start with a spiritual death experience and then need to go back and integrate ourselves and develop positive emotion. Or we might have glimpses of the nature of reality right from the outset and then need to understand the whole framework, the conceptual framework and the framework of Sangha and so on, to contextualize our experience and bring our what's an individual experience into relationship with the world, as it were. Some people, for instance, have a facility for meditation. They find it easy to shoot up into the higher dhyanas and have wonderful peak experiences, even insight experiences. And that's very good for nurturing faith, for instance. However, there is a danger with that, and that danger is the danger of misinterpreting experience. So most serious wrong views are based on misinterpretation of strong meditation experiences. There's one Mahayana sutra, I was reading this just recently, where the Buddha talks about the need to always check that our experiences accord with the Dharma. He says, check whether what you have experienced accords with the sutras. If it does not, you should regard it as a false mental construction. So the point being made is that what we experience in the privacy of our own mind, as it were, it might be you experience something like as if there was a message coming to you or something like that. That needs to be checked out. Otherwise, we can go off on a detour. Mm. In the Brahmajala Sutta, which is a sutta where the Buddha lists, I think it's 62 wrong views. A lot of those wrong views are based on meditation experience. So the point I'm making is that meditation experience or any insightful or strong experience of that nature needs to come into relationship with the rest of Buddhist practice and teaching. You know, it needs to come into relationship with that so that it's contextualized and on the right track, so to speak. For instance, the Noble Eightfold Path starts with perfect vision, but then the whole rest of the Noble Eightfold Path is all about transformation. So it's like taking that initial experience, whatever it was that sparked you off to want to live a spiritual life or whatever, taking that and then transforming yourself. And to do that, it has to come into connection with other people, but also with all of the dharmas or the other practices. So in a sense, we never really stop needing to integrate and needing to practice skillfulness. Skillfulness being another way of talking about positive emotion. We never really stop needing to see reality more clearly and so on. Gradually what happens is the stages of the practices and so on change from being a discipline or a practice into being more the spontaneous expression of spiritual creativity. So something that starts out as a practice gradually becomes something that's just a spontaneous expression of spiritual creativity. So any formulated path is like a helpful map and compass, yeah? And we need to travel the path, and we might get lost from time to time. We might get distracted by detours or interesting side streets or whatever. And that's why it's not enough just to have the map and compass. It's not enough just to have the description of the path. We also need friends and mentors, yeah, teachers and so on, to remind us and to guide us. So our friends and our guides, our mentors, or whatever, may be able to re-inspire us when we lose our motivation. Or they may be able to remind us of our overall purpose when things are going well. Because sometimes when things are going well, we can also lose sight of what we're about. Or our mentors may be able to guide us when we're confused, or even when we're over-enthusiastic. Because sometimes we can get over-enthusiastic about some particular method or some particular aspect of training or something like that. But of course, if we're to benefit from friends and mentors, we have to be receptive. We have to be receptive to what they're, the guidance that we've been given. And if we're to benefit from a Dharma talk, we have to be receptive. Yeah. So this is a segue back into my talk. The first level of wisdom is often talked about as listening or hearing. Suttamayi prajna or shruttamayi prajna, hearing or listening. So you have three levels: there's the listening, the reflecting, and the meditating. But this first level is simply about hearing the Dharma, listening to the Dharma, taking it in. Yeah, taking in what you're hearing. So you need to hear it, listen to it, take it in before you can reflect on it and meditate on it and so on. And that might seem simple, but sometimes that's surprisingly difficult because our minds operate all sorts of filters, as it were, where we have our own thoughts and our own reactions and responses to everything we hear. We have our own interpretations of everything we hear. And what we're trying to do in terms of hearing or listening, we're trying to allow things to go through that filter and just take it in. And then later we reflect on it, as it were. But we need to kind of take it in. And we need to try and take it in its totality. Because again, our filtering, our ways of responding and reacting, sometimes we'll let that bit in and keep that bit out. Yeah, and that's not, if we're doing that, that's not the first level of wisdom. The first level of wisdom, we're trying to drop the filtering process and allow the things to come in. Even if we think they're outrageous and, you know, how could you possibly say that? We just take it in and then later we reflect on it in relationship to the rest of the Dharma, yeah? I'm not going to say anything outrageous, by the way, in my five talks. Of course, I don't know. Depends on what you find outrageous, I guess. So we have to listen and hear the Dharma first before we can reflect and meditate on it and begin to embody it. And in order to hear or to listen to something, we need an open mind. Not one that's full of predetermined ideas and interpretations. There's probably most of you have heard that Zen story. There's always a Zen story with a Zen master, yeah? So there's the Zen story of the Zen master who, and the professor comes to visit him, and the Zen master invites him to tea, and the Zen master is pouring the tea. And he pours the tea, and he pours the tea, and he keeps on pouring, even though the cup is full. So it's going all over the table. And the professor shouts, "My cup is full!" And the master, of course, says, "Yes, your cup is full. Come back when your cup is less full, then I can teach you." Yeah? So the point there is that the professor, as it were, had too much going on in his head, as it were. He had too many predetermined ideas and so on to actually listen and take in the teaching. And when we hear that story, we might identify with the Zen master, but actually probably the story is meant to tell us that we're more like the professor, yes? That's... So as well as an open mind, we need to be interested and we need to want to learn, yeah? And of course, listening is not just a passive thing. So we're very used to being entertained by the movies, by soap operas, by box sets, and it can be easy for us to approach Dharma talks in the same way. We sit back and we wait to be entertained or informed, yeah? But listening to Dharma talks is part of this first level of wisdom. It's a practice in itself. It's a practice of this first level of wisdom. So we have to bring as much of ourselves as possible to the practice of listening to Dharma talks and actively engage, yeah? And I don't mean just the Dharma talks I'm giving over the next few weeks. I think any Dharma talks, no matter who's giving them, that's what we have to do. And people have different ways of doing that. Some people take notes, some people listen to them again, listen to the recordings, some people just go away and discuss things with their friends and so on. There's a very senior order member who lives at Padmaloka, Surita, and he takes notes of every talk he listens to. And he's been doing this for like 40 years, and he keeps them all. He's got notes of every talk he's ever listened to. And he does that because when he's listening to a talk, taking notes helps him to really engage with it and listen to it. And it doesn't matter then who is speaking. It's one way of actually getting beyond this thing of focusing on the speaker rather than the content. Because actually the speaker is not that important. It's the content that's important, yeah? You could say that every Dharma talk is a good talk because it's the Dharma, not because it's the speaker, but because it's the Dharma. Of course, it's much better to be actually present hearing a Dharma talk than just listening to it on a recording device later, because there's something you get from being present that you don't get from listening. I think for a start, you get the rest of the audience for a talk. You get the room and the atmosphere and so on, which you don't get when you're just listening to a recording. Not that I've got anything against recordings. I'm very much involved myself with Free Buddhist Audio, so I also want you to use Free Buddhist Audio. So yes, receptivity is the spirit that we need to bring to listening to Dharma talks. Well, receptivity and active engagement, yeah? And receptivity is also, as I said, an essential ingredient on the whole path, and I will talk about that again in the last talk. But I thought it was worth mentioning right here at the beginning so that we can try to approach these talks and all talks remain in this right spirit, with the right attitude, this spirit of openness to the Dharma, a keenness to learn and get different perspectives on things. So as I said, every Dharma talk is a good talk because the Dharma is good, and our task is to stay open to that goodness, as it were, to allow it to touch us, yeah? So if you have an open mind, an open heart, you could say, if you want to learn, or as it sometimes says in the Buddhist scriptures, it says the monks are eager for instruction. So if you're eager for instruction, if you're willing to change, then you're going to have a stimulating few weeks as we go through this series of talks, from getting going with integration, yeah, all the way through to the final letting go, yeah, when we let go of the path and let go of the practitioner in that kind of great wave of energy that's spontaneous, compassionate activity. So this is the road that we're taking. This is the journey that we're embarking on. And I'm just going to finish with a quote from Walt Whitman, just to get us started on this road. And it's this one. Some of you will be familiar with this. Not I, not anyone else can travel that road for you. You must travel it for yourself. It is not far. It is within reach. Perhaps you have been on it since you were born and did not know. Perhaps it is everywhere, on land, on water and on land. Shoulder your duds and I will mine, and let us hasten forth. Wonderful cities and free nations we shall fetch as we go. If you tire, give me both burdens, and rest the chuff of your hand on my hip, and in due time you shall repay the same service to me, for after we start, we shall never lie by again. Okay, thank you.